Good morning. Good morning. So last time we finished talking about HCL. We went through our built-in components. So we learned about register files and memories before, learned how that correlates to our hardware description language implementation where those components are provided for us. We went through more details about how signals, which we called wires in our hardware description language, work, and options for debugging and doing interactive, quote-unquote, interactive operations cycle by cycle. Then we looked more systematically at our processor stage by stage for our textbook's idea of stages and talked about the various places where we needed to make decisions in that, where we needed extra muxes, therefore, because that's how in hardware we make a decision to do different things for different types of instructions. And we mentioned that we had some options to do things different than the textbook. So for example, the textbook has made a choice that anything computed by the ALU that's stored in the register goes through the E input. Anything computed from memory that goes into a register goes through the M input, but that's not something you have to do. And the textbook also made the choice that for IR move Q, rather than just sending the value directly into the register file using a mux to decide when to do that, they put it through the ALU first, because it saved a little bit of wiring, and you don't have to do that. Both are valid choices. Any questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so one thing I'd like to talk about is performance. So we're going to talk, now that we have our processor that executes one instruction per cycle, about, well, how fast is it? And what are other designs that might be faster? And to do this, we need to talk about something known as critical paths. And the idea here is that in our processor, we have our clock cycle. So remember, we have our rising edge that starts a clock cycle into a falling edge into a rising edge, and this is the time during which our instruction executes. And remember, the timing was that at this rising edge we start, and we know we're starting because the PC changes, and that PC register triggered everything else to start executing our new instruction in our single cycle design. And things flow through, and eventually, by this point, we have to have everything ready for writes. And so on this slide, I say we need a path from every state output, so a state output like the program counter, the new register value, to every input, because we need, by the time that next rising edge happens, that when we read the new value, it's there. And ready, so for that rising edge, we can store it and move on. And the amount of time it takes our signal to go from our state outputs, like our program counter register, and do all the work to get our state inputs, like our next program counter register or our new values for memory or register files, that's going to determine how much time this clock cycle needs. We are going to set the time between these rising edges of the clock long enough that we're never going to run into a problem that when we get to this next rising edge, everything isn't ready for those inputs, for those things we need to write to registers, memories, and so on. And that means that we need to worry about the slowest path from some output to some input. And there's going to be multiple of them we need to consider. So let's look at our processor here. and think about what are the paths that go from an output to an input. So here is our primary output. This triggers everything. And one thing that needs to happen every clock cycle is that after this PC changes, we need to be able to have this plus operator compute the right value. So one path that we need to worry about is that when this PC changes, we need to have enough time to send a new value to the plus operator and have it take that into account. And we're going to generally say that when we have components like this adder, it's going to take some amount of time. How much time? Well, hopefully whoever designs the adder is going to tell us how long it needs. And we need enough time for the value to propagate through that adder and the adder to take into account what the new value of the PC is. I'm saying, okay, that takes 25 picoseconds along with the time needed to go through this mux, which might take some amount of time. So the mux can't instantaneously decide which signal to send through. It needs some time to, given a signal coming in, to have that signal go out, because there's some processing that needs to happen in between. Okay. Then we have another path. So another thing which needs to happen when our program counter changes is we need to send it through the instruction memory and have it go from the instruction memory, extract the information to compute the instruction length, and that's going to take some amount of time. And then we need to be able to send that through our adder, have the adder take that into account, and then have that go through our mux again. And I'm saying, let's say that this takes 50 picoseconds, which I'd find out by looking up whoever gave me my instruction memory, how long does this take? Whoever gave me this instruction length circuit, how long does that take? Given an input to go to an output, I just add up all the times along this path to compute the length of time I need. Yes?
So are those two latencies overlapping?
So the question is, are these two latencies overlapping? And the answer is yes. So we only care about the longest one, because as long if this green path is shorter, it's not going to matter in the overall. It's going to happen at the same time as the yellow path, and we're not going to care about it. So we're going to only care about the longest one of these paths, and that's what we're going to call the critical path. And as you might guess, probably for this processor, this orange path isn't the critical path, because it seems like we have a lot of extra stuff to go through that's probably going to take more time than what I've drawn, the path I've drawn so far. So let's say another thing which needs to happen every cycle is that when the PC changes, it needs to propagate through the instruction memory, it needs to take that into account, read the value, then we need to extract the register number from that, send that to the register file needs to process that and figure out how to start outputting the correct register value of all the 15 choices it has. That needs to go through this mux here and then through the ALU. The ALU result needs to become stable, you know, not changing anymore, and we need to have that ready on the register file, and the register file needs enough time to process that input and store it. So it's ready for the rising edge of the clock and can do the write then. So this is another path that needs to happen. I'm saying, let's say this takes 400 picoseconds. Now, what's going to happen when we're running our clock cycle is that, well, our clock cycle needs to be at least 400 picoseconds. And we're going to have our rising edge of the clock. And we're going to, you know, have, after some amount of time here, we're going to do 1 and 2 are going to be ready. We're going to have enough time for that. And we'll have computed probably the right value to go here by then. That input will be correct. But that doesn't mean we can have our rising edge of the clock yet, because at this point in time, the register file is still working. You know, and we need until sometime way over here for the register file to finish working, and then the ALU to finish working. So the register file is like working somewhere over here, then the ALU is working somewhere over here, and so on. So we need all that time to happen, and it's going to happen in parallel with weakness. So probably the register file is doing the read at the same time as we're doing the add to the PC, for example. Because the hardware, all that it cares about is when do its inputs change, then it starts doing stuff. It's just a matter of how long does it take from when its input change to when it can produce an output. So then we have maybe another path. So probably our actual worst case is this red path here, where we go through the register file, then we go compute an address with the ALU, send that through our memory, data memory, which needs to figure out the value there, and then store that back in the register file. And if these are the amount of times each of these lines take, my clock cycle needs to be at least 900 picoseconds. And we're going to set a single clock cycle. We're not going to try to vary it based on what instruction we're running. That is very complicated to do and not a type of processor design that people generally have. So we're going to have a fixed clock cycle time. And to figure out what it is, we're going to do this analysis and we're going to say, okay, this red line is my worst case. And I know that happens in 900 picoseconds. That's my clock cycle. You know, even though you might say, well, most instructions don't use the data memory. You know, we could run them quicker. And yes, you know, maybe we could figure out a clever way of doing that, but that's not generally worthwhile for our single cycle processor design. Okay, so questions? So this longest path here, this is going to be our critical path. And it's going to determine how long we need to actually set our cycle time. And we can do this analysis for every circuit, and we actually want to go through all the paths. So like I didn't enumerate every single possible path. Probably the red one is the longest one, or is equally long as any of the other longest ones. But to actually do this analysis, you want to enumerate every possible path between every thing which takes an output at the beginning of the cycle and needs an input by the beginning of the next cycle, and see how long does it take given the specifications whoever supplied me the adder and the register file and the ALU wrote, and make that sure that's long enough. And we can do this analysis for other circuits and so on. And the general rule, and here I've shown all the possible paths, so this is sort of more the analysis we do. I didn't show all the possible paths for the normal processor because there's too many of them, and we say, okay, the longest path, that's our cycle time. Okay, so now we understand what our cycle time is going to be like, and for our single cycle processor, every single clock cycle we run exactly one instruction. So if we want to know how fast a program runs, we say, how many instructions does it run, and how long is our cycle time, and that tells us. And we're going to talk about alternate processor designs where we're going to do some work to change the cycle time in order to make things faster. But when we change the cycle time, we're going to get rid of this property that we actually run one instruction every cycle. But when we do this, when we don't run one instruction every cycle, we're going to run instructions slower, so each instruction is going to take more than one cycle, we're going to do it in a way which is going to eliminate waste. And to talk about that, I'm going to talk about an example of this concept with a more human issue, which is going to be laundry. So let's say I have some laundry to do, and I have more than one load worth, so I'm going to take my whites, my light colored clothing, I'm going to do that load, I'm going to put it in my washer, I'm going to wait for that to finish, then I'm going to move that to my dryer, wait for that to finish, take everything out of the dryer, fold it, put it away, and then I'm going to say, okay, now I have my next load, take it up, put it in my washer, then wait for that to finish, then put that in the dryer, wait for that to finish, then fold everything, and now I'm done with my laundry, you know, 3 hours later. So, anyone think there's a better way I could have done this? Anything? It seems weird, yeah. Yeah, so the washer is completely unused here. And an observation you might have is that this is the same thing that was happening with our circuits, that if we think about this critical path here, after I went through the instruction memory, basically I wasn't using it anymore. And we need some small amount of time to go through this instruction memory relative to the amount of time on this red path that goes through this register file in the adder. So conceptually, the timeline for our circuit does look something like my timeline for each load of my laundry. And what we do with laundry is we'd say, okay, let's not leave the washing machine doing nothing after I've gotten my clothes out of it. Let's put in the next load right away. We got the result from the washing machine. That's perfectly fine. Let's move on to the next thing right away. And I can do the same thing for my dryer. I can say, okay, I'm done with one load in my dryer. I can move on to the next one right away. I don't need to wait until it's all folded. I can just transfer it to the folding tables, load the dryer, and then fold while another thing is drying. And with this strategy, now I can fit 3 loads of laundry in the same amount of time and have some time to spare. And this is a basic principle of when one thing is done, you do the next operation on it we're gonna do. And notice the idea is that we're actually doing 3 loads at once. And we're doing part of the work for 3 loads all at the same time. And that's why we're getting sort of this big boost in efficiency. Now, this isn't sort of perfectly using our washer and dryer. So one thing to notice is that there's some waste. So I have this time here where when I'm doing the strategy of, oh, the washer's free, start a new load, that I can't actually have the washer be used all the time. And if you think more realistically, I'm saying that my dryer takes roughly as long as my washer. That's not very common. So probably the scenario looks something more like this. Okay, so let's think about what the consequence of this waste is. And this is going to tell us something about how we want to measure efficiency. Because you have the intuition that this is obviously the way you should do laundry, but we have this waste here, and this means that when we consider how long it takes me to do each load of laundry, if that's what you ask me, I would say, well, I'm going slower. And the reason I'd say that is, well, if I look at how long it takes me to do my second load, I started around 11:30, ended a little past 1:30, so it's 2.1 hours. So it took me 2.1 hours, but if I was doing this load one at a time, like my original plan, I'd be faster. It would take me 1.8 hours, because I wouldn't have that wasted time waiting for the dryer to be free. So this time is what we'll call latency. This is the time from when I started doing my load of laundry to when I finished it. And by doing this process of let's do multiple loads of laundry at once, I've made it slower. And if you told me, do laundry so you do each load as fast as possible, therefore, this is the wrong strategy. But when you tell me to do my laundry as fast as possible, this is not the time you care about. And the same thing is true when we talk about processors. If you tell me to execute instructions as fast as possible, you don't actually care how long each instruction takes. What you care is how long all the instructions together take. So we don't want to look at this time so much. We want to look at the time for each instruction to finish, the sort of rate at which we do instructions. We don't want to look at the time for each instruction because we know we're doing multiple at a time, and that's where we're getting this boost in efficiency. And we're only going to see that if we measure the rate at which we do instructions, not how long each one took, because we have this overlap. So the time at which we, the rate, the time between which we can start new instructions or finish new instructions is known as the throughput. And you can measure this in lots of ways. So one way of looking at it is that the time between when we finish instructions, or in this case, when we finish loads of laundry, when once we get started, there's some beginning and end stuff where it's a little different, but once we get started, the time between when we finish loads of laundry gives us a rate. And here I say I finish one load every 0.8 hours, so it's about 1.2 loads per hour. And that's what I'm going to say, and I'm saying how fast can I do laundry? That's usually the number I care about, assuming I have enough loads of laundry. So if I only have one, this is not what I actually care about. I care about when do I start, when do I finish. If I have like 10, this is the only thing I really care about. And if I have 3, I'm kind of in between. And if we think about our processors, if we think about a typical program, we probably want to execute like millions of instructions. So this is the number I care about. How long between when I finish instructions, not how long did each instruction take, because we know that time overlaps with other instructions when we're doing things in the most efficient way. Okay. And note that because when everything is in use, I have to wait in line, that the time between when I finish loads of laundry is the same as the time between when I start loads of laundry, because I need to wait for a load to finish, for the next one to start, to free up something. In fact, in this case, to free up the dryer. I can't start the next load until one finishes to move on to the next step. And this is generally going to be true in this type of scheme, that we need to wait for the slowest component to free up a space before we can push something in, because we can't add the next thing until the thing in front of it can advance. So I can't start this load until this load can move into the dryer, and I can't finish a load until the previous thing gets out from the dryer. So in both cases, our performance is based on the slowest component here. So in this case, the dryer is determining how fast I can do my laundry. And it wouldn't help me to buy a washer which was twice as fast. That would not speed up how fast I did laundry in terms of throughput. Even though if I look at sort of the latency when I'm doing one load at a time, that would make things faster. So any questions about this latency and throughput? So these are the two big measurements we're going to care about. So latency in our processor is the time not to do one load of laundry, but to do one instruction from start to finish. And throughput is the rate at which we finish or start instructions. And we're going to be using a processor design that looks more like this than like my original picture up here, which is the current processor we have. Our single cycle processor is this design. We go through all the steps. Sometimes there's some stuff happening in parallel, but basically we have to do each thing, one instruction memory, then register file, then adder, and so on, kind of like this. And we have a lot of time where we aren't using, say, our instruction memory effectively. And this is what we're fixing with this, what is called a pipeline design, where we do multiple things at once in this sort of assembly line fashion. So I've talked about doing this for laundry, so we're going to want to make this work with circuits. And to do that, we're going to have to change a few things about the circuit to make it work. It's not going to just be that we send in new values more frequently and it just happens. We're going to need to do a little extra. And to illustrate this, I'm going to have this example circuit, which multiplies a value to higher 3 in a not very efficient way. So I compute 2 times A, and then I compute 3 times A. And this is an example of a circuit which has that same problem that for most of the time we aren't using these two adding components, which are presumably where all our time is going to be taken. So if we say insert the value 7, and let's say the adder takes 50 picoseconds to actually do an addition once it has its inputs ready, well, this first adder is going to take 50 picoseconds from when it has 7 on both of its inputs to produce a stable output. So we know the output won't be changing anymore. So our 2 times A value will be, you know, changing and possibly not stable until about 50 picoseconds, and then it's going to have 14. And at that point, this second adder, it will have 2 stable inputs, so we know that after another 50 picoseconds, it will take those 2 inputs and produce a stable output. So another 50 picoseconds, we get our result of 21. And we have our pattern that we didn't like with the laundry of, well, we're using the adder here, the first adder here, and the second adder here, and we have this time here when we wish we could use that first adder. It's just sitting there doing nothing. And we have this time here when we wish we would be using the second adder. It's just sitting there doing nothing. And we'd like to adjust the circuit so we can do more multiplying things times 3 by starting the next multiply times 3 right here so we can use this empty space. Just like I started the next load of laundry right away so I could use the unused time of the washer. So when we're starting, we have 100 picoseconds latency, and because our latency is also how often we finish things, that gives us 10 results per nanosecond of throughput. And our hope is by starting something right away, we'll be able to improve this throughput number. And it turns out there's going to be an effect on latency, though it's not obvious why yet, and we'll talk about that later. But our goal is that we think that this result matters. So I'm going to try to improve the throughput. The idea is I want something which does as many multiplies times 3 as possible, as fast as possible. So what we conceptually want to do is we want to take our timeline of multiply a value times 3, then do it again, where we again have this unused time for adders. We want to sort of compress that, so we start multiplying 7. So we compute 7 plus 7, and then we compute 14 plus 7 during the next time to get 21. But while we're computing 14 plus 7, we input the next number right away, so our first adder can use this. Can use that value and start computing 17 plus 17 while we're computing 14 plus 17. So we compute the value from the second instruction, our second thing to multiply times 3, while we're doing that last part of dealing with the first instruction, the first thing to multiply times 3. So this is the timeline we want, but we can't exactly get this for free. And the big problem is that if we look at this circuit here, well, once I change this A here, if I change A from 7 to 17 here, then this value is not going to be 14 anymore, it's going to start changing. So I can't just insert 17 right here with this circuit and expect it to work, because we're kind of using this first adder over here, even though that space is blank, not to actually compute a value, but to hold the value of 2 times a is 14. You know, that's all it's doing. But you might say an adder is an awfully wasteful thing just to hold a value for a while. So we're going to use another way of holding that value so we can change this a while keeping this 2 times a value the same. And that's going to be a register. So we're going to put a register here to hold that value of 14. So we can keep track of that value of 14 while this adder is computing the next value of, say, 17 plus 17 is 34. We also need to hold the first value of a for the second adder, because we don't want this, when we're importing 7 initially here, 7 initially on here, if we change that to 17, then the second adder is going to start adding 17 plus 14 if we only kept this value unchanged. So we also need to hold the value that we initially input for a separately. And the way I do that again is with a register. So one way of thinking about it is I wanted to divide this circuit into two halves. So I just drew a line right here to dividing the two halves. And everything that crossed that line, I put a register there. So I have this labeled as, I have a t plus 0. So this is the value we input at time t. We have 3 times a for that. And at the same time, the value we input 1 time unit later is here. And the value we input 2 time units later is here. So values flow in. So here we have the oldest value. And here we have the newest value. Values flow in that direction. So to give an example of our, initially we input 7 initially, and presumably these are our clock cycles. So we have our starting clock cycle, we start inputting a 7, and during this starting clock cycle here, we get a 14 here and a 7 here, which means that at the rising edge of the clock, that we output from here, we start outputting 7, because that was the input of this register before the rising edge of the clock. And from here, we output 14, which I've shown here, 7 and 14. And because we now are storing 7 and 14 in these two registers, we can start outputting a different value from our main first register that feeds in this case, 17. Then, while we have 7 and 14 in there, 17's in here, all these values get copied on the rising edge of the clock to the other side of the register. So over here, we're outputting 17 from here, we're outputting 14 on this wire and 7 on this wire. And that's during this time. And that means that during that clock cycle, we compute our 21 here. And finally, during the next rising edge of the clock, so we have our clock signal keeps going. Next rising edge of the clock, we have, we have right here. At this time, we end up having 21 on here, and our values from previous input of 17 and 34. Which would have been input during, were the inputs during the previous cycle before the rising edge of the clock. That was right here. Okay, so questions about the operation here? So the idea is at this time, 34, 17, and 21 were sitting here. And along with the outputs of 14 and 7. Yeah?
Can you clarify one more time how AFT plus 2 gets updated?
How does AFT plus 2 get updated? So I didn't talk about that, and that's a good question. So there must be some input, because it's a register, that's feeding in values. And I haven't described what it is, but part of making the circuit is that something is going to feed in values. You know, before, at this time, we're going to feed in a 7, and we're going to get out the values from this register a bit later, and we have registers at either end, so we can feed in values and not have to do it at the very, very beginning of the clock cycle. We can do it in the previous clock cycle, and we can take out values and use them during the next clock cycle. Other questions about what's going on here? Okay, so I have this timeline, and remember earlier I said my assumption was that this adder here takes 50 picoseconds, and this one takes 50 picoseconds. And you might assume, therefore, that we'd have that this point would be 50 picoseconds, because that seems like our critical path, that our critical path is from here going through to here, and, or from here going through to here, and those both take 50 picoseconds, so our cycle time is 50 picoseconds. And that's almost true, but there's one issue we have to deal with. And the problem is that these registers aren't free. When I'm doing that, I'm saying the registers don't actually take any time, that we get the value instantaneously at the beginning of the clock cycle. And as long as the value is ready just before that rising edge, everything's fine. But registers are physical things and have some tolerances, which means that they can't actually precisely act on that instant. They're not instantaneous. So there's some amount of time before the rising edge of the clock during which the input to the register can't change, or the register won't know what the value is. And there's some amount of time afterwards where the register is changing between, in this case, the blue and the green value, where the output won't be stable yet. And we're going to call the total sum of these two times the register delay. And when we set our clock cycle based on our critical paths, we need to account for this extra time. Because we need to add that to our clock cycle to make sure that we have the values ready. And as for how long are these times, well, the way you'd find out in practice is whoever designed the registers you're using will tell you, this is my time I need before the rising edge of the clock, this is the time I need after, and you'll use their specifications to help set your clock cycle time. But this is something that we have to deal with, and it's going to mean that even though I divided up my times three operation into two equal pieces, which take the same amount of time, that my latency is going to be increased. I'm going to have some waste. The waste isn't that I had my dryer, which was much slower than everything else. The waste is that now I need to save the value somewhere other than in my adder, and that takes a little bit of time. Yeah.
Sorry, what do you mean by input must not change?
So during this, the question is, what do I mean by input must not change? So during this, the time represented by this box, the register expects the input to not be changing. If it is changing, the register might read the wrong value, might read one of the earlier values partially, and that would produce very confusing results. Okay. Other questions? So given these register tolerances, we get some timing like this, that each of these registers, let's say the register delay is 10 picoseconds. This means that my latency now is not 100 picoseconds, but I have to go through these extra registers. And depending on where we start and end counting, I have like around 30 picoseconds of extra latency. Not because things I have to wait in line for a slow adder, but because I need to have the values be stashed somewhere in between doing the additions. And that has a cost. And if you think about my laundry scenario, that is actually a cost I should have accounted for but didn't. I just said, once I finish the washer, I instantaneously start doing the dryer, but that's not really how it works. I need to move things, there's a cost to moving things. And we have to actually account for that here. So our latency is all of these together. Let's think about our throughput. What's our throughput like? So remember when I talked about throughput, it's the rate at which we finish things or start things. And they should be the same because we can't finish the next thing. We can't start the next thing until we finish another thing to make space for more stuff to do. So what should the throughput here be? Volunteers. Yeah. 60 picoseconds is going to determine our throughput. So, yeah. So the notion is that to start the next thing, we need to wait for it to go through one of the registers, then go through the adder. And after that's done, we can start the next operation. So our throughput is one operation every 60 picoseconds, or about 16 billion operations a second. In this case, I said we take the time it takes to go through this register and get to the beginning of this one. I could have also said something like half the time of that register and half the time of the next and gotten the same result. So it depends on how you divide things up, as long as you're consistent of including one of the registers or half of each two registers in your thing I have to do every clock cycle. So we start one operation every 60 picoseconds, so we have a throughput of 16 billion operations a second. So if this were perfect, we'd have 20 billion operations a second, one every 50 picoseconds. So it's not perfect. But this is still a lot faster, assuming what we care about is not latency, but how many things we could get done overall. Okay, so any questions about this? Okay. So here, we've divided our multiplying times 3 into two equal parts and gotten something that's not quite twice as fast by taking advantage of that, where by fast I mean how much multiplying times 3 get done over a long period of time, not about how long each multiply times 3 takes. And, well, I divided this up into two pieces. We could maybe do better. Why don't we just divide things up into 4 pieces? I just drew a line and added registers to store values. So just draw not one line, but 3. And we do this, let's say, you know, let's say we just divide those ads in half. So we have a 25 picosecond first half of an ad, 25 picosecond second half of an ad, and our 10 picosecond register delay. What's our throughput now? So we can do one thing every 35 picoseconds, so our throughput is one operation every 35 picoseconds, which turns out to be about 28 billion operations per second. So by dividing things up into four pieces instead of two, we ended up to something a little less than three times faster. And note that we computed this throughput by saying we need to go through one register, or maybe half of this register and half of the next one, plus the computation in between. And note that I was using the critical path analysis. So yes, going from here to here doesn't involve going through an adder, but that doesn't matter. We care about the slowest thing we need to do in every piece. But we see here that it's less than three times faster splitting it up into four pieces. And this is a general pattern that we'll see because we have this added cost of more and more latency, more and more register delays when we add these registers. And if we want to take this concept to the extreme, we're really going to start paying for that relatively small cost of storing the values and having them available for the next cycle. You know, so initially we took, you know, maybe 110 picoseconds, assuming we need to store the result in a register afterwards. Then we got down to 60. Then, you know, even if we split up things perfectly, we end up with 43. And our limit is, well, we can never get lower than 10. Even if we can somehow split the logic up into 100 little pieces, you know, we have that 10 picosecond register delay, and it becomes a larger and larger portion of what we do every step. So this means that in terms of the time between when we complete things, we have this sort of asymptotic behavior where we head towards the register delay. So we're limited by the register delay as we add more and more stages to our computation. And this is the inverse throughput view. This is the time per completion. So this isn't latency. Latency is increasing. This is the time between when we can complete, in this case, multiplies by 3, or the time between when we can start multiplies times 3. We look at our actual throughput. We have asymptotic in the other way, because it's 1 over that, where we'll eventually get closer and closer to this 100 operations per nanosecond mark, which is, in the case of our 10 picosecond register delay, what we'd get if we had no computation and just register delays. We only have those times where the registers needed to change their output and read their inputs. And note that adding the first stage, you know, splitting up into two, we got almost a 2x boost. And when we're talking about going from splitting things up into 14 pieces versus 15, we're talking about, yeah, it's faster, it's 2% faster. So these are some diminishing returns. Now, this assumes that we just split everything up evenly. And there's a good question of, this seems kind of crazy, just drawing a register in the middle of an adder. Like, do adders work that way? Can we do that? And the answer is probably not. We probably can't do this. We probably can't find a way to take the work an adder is doing and find an exact midpoint and split it there. That doesn't mean we can't take the work the adder is doing and maybe find two different parts. But often when we do that, we end up with some less perfect scenario. So let's say I find a way of splitting things up, but for my second adder, I need to split things up a little unevenly. That I found a convenient splitting place, but it's after 30 picoseconds of work instead of 25. So I can still, with this, do pipelining, but I just have the pipelines are a little uneven because adders just don't give us a place to split up of the work in, at an arbitrary point. So after I do this, what's my throughput?
Varies depending on where you are.
So it varies depending on where we are. So this would be the case if things weren't connected. But I have, like in my laundry scenario, I'm not going to be able to start my next ad until the slowest part is done. So what we care about is going to be, given that, like what's going to determine it, the throughput?
Probably the slowest thing, which is 40.
So this 40 picosecond part, that's going to determine our throughput. That if we're thinking about inserting a new value here, we need to wait for these registers to be ready, and therefore we need to wait for these to be ready. So we're going to wait in line behind that 40 picosecond delay. And this is a general application of that notion of a critical path I talked about earlier. That if we think about the paths from state outputs to state inputs in the circuit, I can say like this is a path, this is a path, this is a path. And I can say, okay, this is including the register at one of the ends. This is 35 picoseconds. This is 35 picoseconds. This path down here is 10 picoseconds. This path is 40 picoseconds. This path is 30 picoseconds. And I say the longest one is 40 picoseconds. That's my cycle time. It doesn't matter I have this 10 picosecond path here and a bunch of these 35 picosecond paths or this 30 picosecond path here. I need to wait for the slowest one anywhere. That's our critical path in the circuit. That's how we determine how long our cycle time is going to be, and therefore, what our throughput's going to be like. So we end up with not 28 billion operations per second, but 25, 1 over 40 picoseconds. Yeah?
So like, how does it know where along the sequence is
going to
be the slowest part?
So how does it know? So the question is, how does who know is the question. So someone who designs the circuit is going to need to set that cycle time. So the job of setting the cycle time is that whoever does that needs to do the analysis I just did of this is 35, this is 35, this is 40, this is 30, this is 10. Like go through all of those and say the biggest is 40, that's my cycle time. So this is going to be part of making one of these pipeline circuits is doing that whole analysis to figure out the cycle time. And in practice, you might do this empirically, you might make sure you have some extra tolerance because maybe the circuits are not consistent, but you'll do that analysis somehow, and that's how you'll set your cycle time. This is part of the job of manufacturing the circuit. So this is another thing which means that, when we're adding these four pieces, now we're getting not almost three times faster, we're getting like 2.5. And this is an issue which is going to come up in our pipelining, that usually we won't find an exact splitting point that splits things up evenly. So for example, maybe when we add two pipeline stages, we end up not dividing it up into 250 picosecond pieces, but maybe something which is 60, something which is 45. They even add up to more than 100 because we divided up something where previously with the single cycle processor, we were doing one operation here and one operation overlapping with that. And now with our pipelining, we end up doing something like this, and we had some operation like here, which feeds that. We end up doing, you know, a timeline that looks more like this with pipelining, where this is our pipeline stage division. Like, we might divide things up so that, like, even the sum of the computation times is higher, because previously things were happening in parallel that no longer are. So it can be worse, not only because we split up unevenly, but because we lose a little of, we spend extra time because we had to figure out a way of splitting things up, and we couldn't capture all the parallelism that existed before. So we end up with these diminishing returns as we can't split things up exactly evenly. So this is going to mean that in practice, we're going to end up, you know, that this concept of dividing up the circuit into stages, well, it's going to help us, it's not going to help us infinitely because of these two issues. The issue of those diminishing returns just from the register delays themselves, and the issue that we have to figure out how to divide up our work somehow so that we have kind of even splits, but we're not going to manage to succeed just because physically we can't just split an adder in half. Okay. So, questions about this? So, now that we've talked about this concept of pipelining, let's talk about applying it to our processor. And this is the real reason our textbook chose the stages they did, because they're going to map pretty neatly into our pipeline. So right now, we're saying we have all these things which write something. They all happen at the end of the cycle. Now we're going to actually make them happen in order, mostly. So we're going to convert these into pipeline stages as follows. So I'm going to make one change, one very big change, and that's that I'm going to merge the fetch and the PC update. And the reason I'm going to do that is I really want to start the next fetch right away. I don't want to say, do something like fetch, then decode, then execute, then do the memory, then do the write back, and then figure out, then do the PC update so I can figure out what to fetch. I want to start fetching the next instruction right here, which means I need to have information computed by the previous, in the previous cycle. It has to be in the fetch stage to do that, in order for me to start that right away. Otherwise, pipelining is not helping me because I can't start a new instruction every cycle, which is the whole point of doing this. Now, some of you might have a complaint. Don't some instructions not know what the next PC is right away? Like, if we think about a conditional jump. Well, if you remember how our processor design worked, we used the ALU stage to also do condition code operations, and that's where we'd figure out whether a conditional jump was taken. And that seems to be after we want the next PC. And that is a problem. It's a problem known as a control hazard, and we'll talk a lot about how we deal with that after the exam. But for now, we're going to deal with cases where we'll just the straight code without that conditional jumps where we can just compute it right away. So let's talk about doing add queue with pipelining. And I'm going to start with a single cycle add queue processor. We're going to make this a pipeline processor that only does adds, just adds to keep things nice and simple. And first, I'm going to highlight my stages. So I have my fetch and PC update, which I said is now one stage. So there's my fetch and PC update. I have my decode stage, my execute stage, and my writeback stage. We call that decode is just reading registers. So I highlighted that top part of the register file. And execute is our adder. We don't have a memory stage in this case because there's no memory operation for just adding registers together. And then I have my writeback stage. And before, our procedure for doing pipelining is I just drew lines between my steps, and everything that crossed those lines, I added registers. And that's what I'm going to do here. But first, I need to fix a little bit of an issue. Now, I have this signal which skips two stages. If I just draw a line right here, then I'm saying that the signal would go from the fetch stage into a register right to the write-back stage. So I'd have cycle one's value to fetch along with some other cycle's value from write-back feeding from there. And a key thing we want to do is we want to keep the values for a single instruction together. We want them to go from fetch to decode to execute to write back. We don't want a shortcut because then we're going to combine values from fetch and execute together, and those are different instructions values that can't be together because they're from different times. So to fix that, I'm going to redraw the line like so. So I just redrew that wire to go this circuitous route, so it goes from fetch to decode to execute to write back. So now all my signals go from one stage to the next without taking any shortcuts. And after I've done that, I'm going to just draw lines between each of the stages. And everything which crosses those lines, I'm going to add registers. Because our idea is that the stage is going to do its work, we're going to store its results in a register for the next clock cycle, and then the stage is going to do work for the next instruction. So our instructions are going to flow from fetch to decode to execute to write back, and as that happens, behind them is going to be the next instruction in the program. So I add these registers here. And this is why I talked about register banks. This is what we want register banks for in HCL. It's the big feature they're helpful for. So this is my pipeline processor with these, what we'll call pipeline registers, separating each of these stages. And sometimes I need to name these registers, so I'm going to call them based on the pairs of stages they're between. So fetch decode for between fetch and decode, decode execute, and execute write back. Okay. So any questions about how I got to my pipeline version of the processor? Okay, so let's step through what happens when we execute it. First, a note on the PC register, you can call this like it's from fetch to fetch. So this is an exception where we're communicating from the fetch stage to the fetch stage, but note that we're sending information about the next instruction. So let's talk about executing a simple program here. I have add or 8 or 9, add or 10 or 11. So the first thing we do is we're going to fetch R8 and R9. So in our initial state, we're going to have out of here the address of 1, of instruction 1. Going into the instruction memory, we're going to get the add R8 or 9 instruction out of there. And therefore, we're going to send register number 8 and 9 into these fetch to decode registers. At the same time, we've computed the address of 2 here, and so the input to our fetch to fetch register, the RPC, is the address of the next instruction. Then a rising edge of the clock happens. And what that does is that's going to copy 8 to the output here, 9 to the output here, and this adder of 2 to the output there. So we end up with a situation like this, that instead of having the address of 2 here, we have it on the other side, and instead of having 8 and 9 as inputs, we have it on the other side, and now our inputs are going to be 10 and 11 from the next instruction. So while we're fetching the next instruction, at the same time, our first instruction, we're going to take this 8, send it through here, and we have the value of R8 and the value of R9 as inputs to our decode to execute registers, along with the value 9 on this register that's going to go eventually into the write back stage. Now, what register do we write to when we get there? Okay, so questions so far?
So you're saying that for that first register, the first decode register, it's like the two R8, R9 first enter through the input side. And then I guess, but when
they
become outputs, then the R10, R11 are going to be on the input?
Yes, because we have multiple clock cycles happening here. So the question is about the timing. So during this clock cycle, we fetch 1. And then we are decoding 1 while we're fetching 2. And that's what this is showing. So we're fetching 2, therefore 8 and 10 and 11 are inputs to the fetch to decode registers, and we're decoding 1, therefore 8 and 9 are going through the register file. And those happen at the same time. Other So then, during our next step, we have these 10 and 11 go to the other side of our registers. So now we are going to be decoding 10 and 11, this instruction 2, here, while we're adding the values for instruction 1. So instruction 1 is an execute. So during next we exec 1 while we decode 2. So instruction 2 is following behind instruction 1, going from stage to stage. So that means during this time we have the value of R10 as input to our decode registers, and we have the value of R8 plus R9 and the number 9 as inputs to our execute to write back registers. Okay, so questions? And finally, we can step through, and the next thing that will happen is that we'll start outputting R8 plus R9 and 9 during the next cycle, so the register file will write those values, and at the same time, we'll be adding R10 and R11 while that happens. So this gives another way of viewing this, is that I can write down the values of each of these signals. And I'm writing this by the values that the pipeline registers are outputting. So first, our PC registers outputting 0, and our pipeline registers don't have anything useful yet because we haven't read any instructions. But we're inputting 8 and 9 into the fetch decode registers during cycle 0. So during cycle 1, they'll output 8 and 9. And at the same time, we input 2 into the PC, so during cycle 1, the PC is going to output 2. During the next cycle, we have our PC outputting 4. We get 10 and 11 being output from our fetch and decode, while the value of R8 and R9 are being output from our decode to execute registers along with the destination register that we need to pass through and use in the write back stage later on. So you can think of the instruction going through the stages as it starts out in fetch, so we have our output for the fetch stage in the PC, and then it moves into the decode stage, so we have our output from the fetch to decode registers in the next cycle, then it moves to execute, so we have our output from decode to execute stage registers. And each of these holds all the information about the instruction. So we send the information about the instruction through these sets of registers. And at each point in time, everything we need to know to execute the instruction is there. So initially, when we're just fetching, we only need its address. After we fetched it, we just need for adds, the register numbers. Then once we've read the values, we need those values later on, along with where we store the results. Then finally, to just store the result, we need the value to store and where to store it. We're passing all the information down, and this happens for all the instructions simultaneously. So once we start, what we know is filling the pipeline, once we get to the first few cycles, we end up with this point where we're fetching this last instruction here while we're decoding at R12, R13, while we're adding R10 and R11, while we're storing R8 plus R9. It all happens at once, and this is why we'll have hopefully a lot better throughput. So questions about what happens in this process? Yeah.
When calculating throughput for this, did we start at cycle 1 or cycle 0?
So when calculating throughput, the question is what cycle do we start at? So throughput is a property of assuming we're keeping the pipeline full, generally. So for throughput, we're not going to be concerned about looking at a picture like this, but we're going to ask how long does each cycle take and how many cycles does it take for each instruction to finish. So one instruction finishes every cycle. And then the question is how long does each cycle take? And well, I haven't told you enough to know that. Other questions? Okay, so we know one instruction finishes every cycle. So our throughput is one instruction per cycle, but how long is a cycle? And to know that, we need to think about our critical paths. And to know that, critical paths, you need to know, well, how long does each of these components take? So here I have some hypothetical times of saying the add to this component takes 80 picoseconds, the instruction memory takes 200, reading from the register file takes 125, the addition takes 100, and the writing to the register file, like setting up to go into the correct register, takes 125. Like these are just made up numbers. To find out these in reality, you'd have to ask the people who made your adder and made your register file, what are the times? And given this, you do our critical path analysis. You say, what's the longest path? And if we do that for the no pipelining case, it's the path which goes from our PC through our instruction memory, through our register file, through our adder, and back through the register file. And it ends up being everything but the add to is on that path. The add to still needs to happen, but it happens while we're reading from the register file. So it doesn't affect the cycle time. So in our non-pipeline case, we get one every 550 picoseconds plus the time for the PC, plus PC register delay. Which I didn't write down and probably ends up mattering a little bit. Or not plus, the PC register delay doesn't matter because that happens in parallel with our add to. With pipelining, we need to worry about what stage is slowest. And the answer is going to be our instruction memory, that we need to have a value go from the PC through the instruction memory into another register. So we have 200 picoseconds plus the register delay. So that means that's our throughput's going to be one thing every 200 picoseconds plus the register delay. Our latency is 800. But that's not what we care about. We care about how fast do instructions finish, or how fast can we start new instructions. Okay, so I think that's where I'll leave off today. So we have a test next week. And I'll do exam review next Tuesday, of course.
So I was